This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Two different types of strategists. There's the type of strategist like Chere Kutsi. His business is just to beat up the other guy, and for that you just need strength. And he's won when he's beaten up the other guy. And the more he beats him up, and the more he ruins him, and the more he drives him into the ground, the more of a victory it is for Chere Kutsi. That's the one kind of gibor. And there's another, there's a military strategist who wants to take a city. His purpose is not to run the city into the ground. On the contrary, he wants to capture the city intact. He wants as little damage as possible done to the city when he captures it. He wants the city to be whole and functioning. He wants the people to be living. He just wants it to be his city. But he doesn't want to destroy the city in the process of capturing. It's not a good general who destroys a city to capture it. That's a bad general. A good general is able to capture a city without destroying it. And so says the Vilna Gaon, you've got two things here. You've got a gibor and a loy chedir. And the Pasuk says, Mishle tells us, Toiv erech apayim mi gibor. Somebody who can control his anger is better than a gibor, is better than a cherikutzir. U'moshel beruchoy miloy chedir. And a person who can control his personality is better than an army general who can capture a city. Says the Vilna Gaon, because there are two categories of midas, of characteristics. The one is the general category, into which all the midas fit. Cruelty, kindness, generosity, miserliness, all the different middas. And on the other hand, you have the middah of kas, the middah of anger. Says the Vilna Gaon, when you're handling the middah of anger, you have to handle it like a cherikutzir. You've got to run it into the ground and destroy it totally. It has no place whatever in the Jewish personality. However, if you have in the other middas, cruelty, stingy, whatever it is, narrowness, pursuit after material things, all the other middos are not meant to be wiped out, they're meant to be rechanneled. You've got to capture them alive because they've got to be used. Every middo, every characteristic, not only kindness but also cruelty, not only generosity but also miserliness, every single middo has to be used at different times in different proportions. And therefore we must never destroy our midas. Even bad midas, even characteristics which appear to be destructive and bad, must never be destroyed. They must be captured like you would capture the city if you were a general. They must be captured whole and delivered into your hands for you to control the way you want it to be. But not destroyed, not annihilated. With the exception of kas, anger, that has to be annihilated, totally destroyed. That's what the Vilna Gaon says. And that is borne out by the Psach of the Rambam in Hilchos Deos chapter 2, where after putting forward the Rambam's whole theory of the golden path between every middah, he says the two extremes, cruelty and kindness, miserliness and spendthrift, and in between there's a golden path which one has to follow. But he says v'cheina kas, and kas also is a midah ro'ohi, it's a adle ma'oid, it's a terribly bad midah, kas, anger. And when it comes to anger, no golden parts. When it comes to anger, you need extremism. You've got to go right to the other extreme. You're never permitted to be angry. And you've got to teach yourself never to get angry. And even over something which deserves to arouse your anger, still you're not allowed to become angry about it. And then he says, if you want to, for educational purposes, you want to be angry, then act angry. But not real anger. You can never be really angry. The Omru, and they said, Omru Chachomim Arishonim, the early Chachomim said, Ko HaKoyes Ki Ilo Oved Avodas Koy Chove. If you get angry, it's as if you're idol worshipping. It's the same kind of category. The Omru, and they said, Shekol HaKoyes, anybody who gets angry, Im Chachom Hu Chachmosom Istalekis Bemenu. If you're a wise person, if wisdom is your strength and you get angry, you lose your wisdom, you become foolish. And even if you're a prophet and you get angry, your prophecy disappears, your ability to prophesy goes. Uvale kas ein chayeim chayim. And people who tend to get angry, their lives are not worth living. Their lives are not lives. Lefichach, therefore, tzivu liisrachek min hakas ad shiyanhig atzmoi shelo yargish afilu lidvorim hamachisim. Therefore, they have commanded us to get so far from anger that we don't even feel those things which cause most people to get angry. Bezohi aderech atzeva, and that's the correct way to be. That you desensitize yourself to the type of things which normally cause anger. We've often talked about the fact that there are two kinds of sensitivity which the world likes confusing. The one is to be sensitive to other people's feelings. The other is to be sensitive to one's own feelings. There's no place in Torah to be sensitive to one's own feelings. When it comes to one's own feelings, one has to be as hard as a stone in terms of being unable to be hurt. But we'll come to that a little bit further in the shir. That's the Rambam, which confirms, of course, in fact it's the basis of the pshat of the Vilna Gaon, which I've just given you on the posuk at the end of chapter 16 of Mishle. And this presents one major difficulty. Firstly, we see here that kaas, anger, is a midah ro'a ad me'oid, it's a terrible midah, which one cannot tolerate whatever. All the other midahs, when there's a time to use them, there's a time to be cruel, there's a time to be kind, there's a time to be hard, there's a time to be soft. But there's never a time to be angry, says the Rambam. And yet we see over and over again in the Torah that the Ribbono Shel Olam is referred to as getting angry. Now sure, his getting angry is not the same as our getting angry, but why does the Torah use those words if it's such a terrible thing? Why does the Torah mislead us into thinking that there's something godly about getting angry too, that the Ribbono Shel Olam himself also gets angry? And furthermore, even if we don't go as far as the Ribbono Shel Olam, in this week's Sedra, Yaakov gets angry twice. Yaakov, the Bechir HaOvos, the choice of all the forefathers, the most balanced of all of them, gets angry twice in the Sedra. The first time he gets angry is with his wife, Rachel. In chapter 30, the beginning of chapter 30, we read, Batere Rachel ki lo yoldo, the Yaakov, and Rachel saw that she was not giving birth to Yaakov. Vatakane Rachel ba'achosel, and Rachel became angry with her sister, became jealous of her sister. Vatomer el Yaakov, and she said to Yaakov, Hova livonim, give me sons, v'im ayin meso anoche, and if I don't have children, I'm going to die. Vayichar af Yaakov b'Rachel, and Yaakov got angry with Rachel. Vayomer, and he said, Atachas Elohim Anochi, am I in place of God? Asher mona mimech privotin, it was he who stopped you from having children. What are you talking to me about? So we see, Vayichar af Yaakov b'Rachel, and Yaakov became angry with Rachel. And although the Medrash does criticize Yaakov on this, and the Ramban brings it, the Medrash only criticizes him for talking harshly to a woman who is in a state of depression, but not for getting angry. There's no criticism against Yaakov for getting angry, for losing his temper. And further on, in chapter 31, you'll remember the story that Lavan comes chasing after Yaakov, ostensibly to look for the idols which is missing from his house. And he searches right through the camp of Yaakov and he doesn't find them. Rachel happens to be sitting on them and he doesn't discover them. And at the end of the whole search, when he's found nothing, then, Vayichal Yaakov Vayorev Belavan. And Yaakov became angry and he started arguing with Lavan. He stood quietly, right through all the search. It's like if you go through customs sometimes, and they pick on you. And they open up, and they start questioning. You stand still, you don't say a word. In case, who knows, maybe they find something that you're not supposed to have, so you don't say a word. And they go through everything, and they open everything, and they unwrap everything, and you've got gifts which you've specially wrapped, and they tear the wrapping over, and you're boiling inside, but you keep quiet. And you wait, and everything, every little thing, what's this and what's that, and they go through your papers, and they go through your cards, and they mess up your files, everything. You're there for an hour and a half, and you've got a meeting on the other end, and you've got people waiting for you at the airport, and there you are, and he's slowly taking his time with everything, and the blood's boiling inside you, and that's what it feels like. And then when all your clothes and everything are just lying out on the thing, he says, okay, you can pack it up now. That's when you get angry. What were you looking for? What did you think you would find here exactly? And that's when Yaakov gets angry. Vayichal Yaakov, and at that point when the search was over, Yaakov gets angry, Vayorev Lavan, and he starts fighting with Lavan. And we'll see just now what he says to Lavan. But again we see Vayichal, he gets angry. And not only is Yaakov not criticized for getting angry, But the Medrash Tanchuma, the Medrash is brought in various places, but the Tanchuma over here brings it, says the following strange statement. Omru, they said, Kapdenuson shel Ovos, veloy piyusin shel Boni. The Ribbono shel Olam prefers the anger of the forefathers rather than the just looking for the word for piyusin. For the, can anybody help me?
The appeasing.
The appeasing, that's right. Rather than appeasement of the Boni of later generations. K'tiv, it says, Vayichar leYaakov vayorev belovam. And Yaakov became angry and he argued with Lavan, Re'ei ma'omale becharus apoy. Let's see now, what is a tzaddik like in his temper? What's he going to say to Lavan? Can you imagine 20 years of frustration? He hasn't lost his temper for 20 years. He's let Lavan fool him every time. He's worked for the wrong girl and he's had to work again. And then he's had to work for the sheep. And now this and that. Right, for 20 years he's been suffering at the hands of Lavan. Finally Lavan comes chasing after him because he thinks that he's stolen something. Do you know how humiliating it is? It's bad enough when the customs are checking because that's their job. But imagine if you walked out of the airport already and you're in your car and you hear police lights flashing and they come and they stop you, they stop the car, sorry, we want to search, we believe you've stolen something. Not even searching for drugs or for customs, stolen, you're a thief. Can you imagine how humiliating that is? Yaakov, in front of all his family, is stopped by Lavan being accused of being a thief, and now his blood boils, now he gets angry and he lets it out. What did he say? Vayan Yaakov vayomer leLavan, and Yaakov answered and he said to Lavan, Ma pishi, ma chatosi. What have I done wrong, Lavan? Where have I hurt you? Hido lakto acharai, that you come running after me. That you've searched my whole house. For 20 years I've worked for you. Your sheep did well. Your rams did well. I didn't eat them. I never brought you treifus animals. Animals that had been destroyed. I looked after them. If something was stolen, I replaced it. I worked through day and night in the heat and in the cold. I didn't sleep. 20 years I've been working for you. You did me out of my salary. What do you want from me, Yaakov? Lover? That's what he says in a state of temper. Says the Medrash, the Ribbono Shel Olam prefers that anger to the piyusim of the bonim. What are the piyusim of the bonim? The Ilu David. What was the case with David? When David was being pursued by Shaul, before David actually became king, he was anointed already, but he hadn't actually taken over. Shaul was still alive. And he's being chased over the countryside by Shaul. And he's being pursued, and he knows that Shaul will kill him. Shaul is out. Shaul believes that David is a moreid b'malchus. He believes that he's out to destroy the kingdom and to destroy the throne. And therefore, pihalocha, Shaul feels that he's entitled to kill David, and he makes it known that that's what he's out to do. And he's out on a chase. He's going to find David. And David and Avishai, his lieutenant, see Shaul's camp down in the valley, fighting a sort of a guerrilla war right up in the hills and all around, and Shaul can't quite get at them. It comes nighttime and the whole camp goes to sleep. And David and Avishai go right into the camp and they're standing by Shaul, lying and sleeping, and Shaul's spear is in the ground next to him, and the guards are all asleep. And Avishai says to David, I'll just stab him once. It won't be a big mess. Just once and it's over, finished. Stab him into the ground and that's it. Says David HaMelech, Chas v'shalom, you can't touch the Mashiach Hashem. Says the Mashiach Hashem, you can't touch Ki im Hashem yegafeno, because the Ribbono Shel Olam will strike him. Or Yoyma Yovo Yomeso, his own day will come and he'll die, or the Milchama Yered Venispe, or he'll go down in war. It's not our business to bring an end to the throne of Shaul HaMelech. Shaul is an anointed man of God and you leave him alone. Says the Medrash, rather the anger of Yaakov than the piyusim, than the appeasement of David. David had to deal with an angry general, with an angry Avishai. And Avishai wanted to vent his anger on Shaul HaMelech. Avishai was getting tired of this pursuit. And at last he had Shaul at his fingertips and he said, I can kill him here and there. And David has to calm the anger of Avishai. Says the Medrash, I rather would have the anger of Yaakov than David's efforts to appease the anger of Avishai. Strange. So not only is Yaakov not criticized for his anger, but he's in fact praised for his anger. So where does this all fit in with the Pasuk in Mishle, with the Rambam that we learned that anger cannot be tolerated ever. That's the first question. First question is, we see in the Rambam halacha, and we see in the pasuk in Mishnah according to the pshat of the Vilna Gaon, which I gave to you, that kaas, anger, is banned absolutely. It can never be tolerated. And yet we see that Yaakov expresses anger and is praised for it, apart from the fact that the Ribbono Shel Olam is often referred to as being angry. That's question number one. Question number two, there's a bit of a contradiction in the Rambam which I've always battled with and never quite come to terms with, where the Rambam has just told us what I told you, that kaas, anger, you have to keep away from altogether. There are two middos about which he says this. There are two characteristics about which he says keep away totally: anger and arrogance. Those are the only two that there's no place for whatever. Yet in the very beginning of Hilchos Deos, the Rambam starts off by saying there are many middos. Each human being has different types of, different proportions of these characteristics. For example, you have a man who gets very angry, and you have a man who's very calm. You have a man who's very arrogant, a man who's very modest. A man who's a big Baal Taiva, a man who's not a Baal Taiva at all. A man who's very broad-minded, and a man who's very narrow-minded. And so on. Then he goes on to define his golden mean, and he says, the correct way is to find the balance between these two extremes. And that is the way which is equidistant from both extremes. Therefore, for example, don't always be angry, he says, and don't be like a dead person who's completely insensitive. Only get angry about major things that are really worth getting angry about. And don't be a big Baal Taiva, and don't be a no Baal Taiva at all. And so he goes through. There are two contradictions in the Rambam. Firstly, in the first perek of Hilchos Deos, in the first chapter, which I've just read to you, the Rambam clearly states that the principle of the golden mean applies to anger the same as to the other midas. Whereas in the second chapter he says, anger, no golden mean at all. Get to the other side of anger, have none of it. That's a contradiction. The second thing is the Rambam, in the first perek, he skips out arrogance. Right? He comes and he says, in the first, very beginning of the first perek, in giving his list of examples, his first one is anger, his second one is arrogance, and then Baal Taiva and various others. When he talks about the golden mean, he says, for example, anger, not too angry, and not like a dead person who doesn't feel. And then he skips arrogance and he goes on. So either way, I understand why he skips arrogance, because in chapter 2 he says there's no golden mean with arrogance. That's the one thing which you've got to keep away from completely. But he says the same about anger. And yet in chapter 1 he says there is a golden mean with anger. And if anger is an exception, if there is an exceptional way where there is a golden mean with anger, why isn't there a golden mean also with arrogance? So we've got to understand the Rambam, and we'll do that at the end of the shiur. What is anger? What is kaas? Those of you who were at the Chumash shiur last Shabbos will remember that the human being is created of two parts. He has a spiritual part, which is a chelek eloika mimal. He has a spiritual part which comes directly from the Ribbono Shel Olam. And he has a physical part which is doesn't come from the animal, it is an animal. So he's got a part which is godliness and a part which is an animal. And he's got to fit these two together and he's got to operate with them. The animal part of us is not necessarily negative. We need it. We can't function without it. You can't do mitzvahs without a body. You can't grow without a body. You can't achieve without a body. So we need the animal part for achievement. If we didn't have bodies, we would be angels. And angels don't achieve. They just sit around singing songs. They're very holy and everything and very pure, but they don't achieve big things. Human beings can achieve. And the reason we can achieve is because we've got a body. If we didn't have a body, we wouldn't be able to achieve. And with our body comes certain basic animal instincts. For example, reflex actions. Reflex actions, in a sense, whenever I go for a medical checkup and the doctor hits my knee and my leg shoots up, I feel terribly humiliated. Touches, no control at all. Just he touches and my leg goes, and then I think I've nothing I can do about it. And I try, I fight against it, just to show him. It's not necessarily reflex action. Doesn't work. Always hits it and the knee shoots up. That's a basic animal instinct. Why is it there? Because the animal needs certain reflex actions to protect itself. If you're walking quietly and you don't know that there's somebody coming up behind you and he punches you in the back, your reflex action is to hit back, to do something, to get him. It's an absolutely reflex action and it's self-defense. If people didn't realize that people had, if people didn't know that others had reflex actions, there would be a lot more aggression in the world. One of the reasons I don't come and hit you, or I'm careful, I don't come and give you a fright, is because I'm afraid of your reflex actions. And people tend to overreact in their reflex actions. They react very fast and they react very powerfully in their reflex actions if they're alert, if they're physically alert. Kaas is a leftover from one that's sort of an evolutionary leftover, anger. Somebody hits you, you hit back. What is anger also? Somebody hurts you, somebody angers you, and you pile into him, you hit back. You can hit back physically, that's one expression of anger. You can hit back verbally, or you can hit back emotionally, but you hurt him back. The basic drive in aggression is to see the other person dead. That's the basic, in different variations, that's the most extreme, but it's the most basic form of aggression. When you get angry, you want to see the other person finished. If he's a competitor in business, you want to see him finished in business. That means you want to see him bankrupt. If he's a competitor in the boxing ring, you want to see him lying on the floor. If he's a competitor for a woman, then you want to see him disappear somewhere. Whatever it is, if two people are competing and a chaos develops, what you want to do is to see the other person dead. And children, psychologists sometimes battle with the death wishes of children. When they get angry and the child wants to see a parent, has to show them dead or something like that. You have such a thing when the child's really angry. It's a normal expression of anger. But it's a reflex action. The same as if somebody hits me, my immediate action is to hit him back as hard as possible. Even a person is busy dying. If a person is stabbed and is busy dying, he'll try before he dies to get the other person too. That reflex thing is still alive. That reflex action is still alive. And kaas, anger, is the development of the basic defensive reflex action into the emotional and the mental area. That means if somebody hurts me emotionally, I'll hit back. If somebody hurts me mentally, I'll hit back. Part of that same reflex. And it's different when you see somebody approaching you before he actually hits you. Then you're defensive. If you see somebody coming at you with a knife, you'll figure out what can you do to defend yourself. You'll put your arm up, you'll get ready, you'll pick something up, something to hold in front of the knife. If you see him coming at you with a fist, you'll get ready to shield yourself from his fist. It's only after he's hit you that you'll hit him. There are two different reflex actions. When you're being threatened, the reflex is to defend. When you have been hurt, the reflex is to hurt back. That's how an animal behaves. That's how we behave in terms of reflexes. The first thing one has to understand is that if one's operating on the right level, there's no way another person can hurt one. That's all. I don't know those of you who remember, if you saw it a long time ago, if you didn't, if you've seen the replay of it, in the film Lawrence of Arabia, which is an interesting and a worthwhile film in many ways, right at the very beginning, old Lawrence lights a match and he holds it until the flame burns, until the flame comes right down, and he holds it until the match goes out, until his fingers basically extinguish the match. And there's another young army fellow there who thinks of some kind of trick and tries the same, and it burns, and he drops it, and he says, "How did you do it?" He says, "It hurts." So Lawrence says, "Sure it hurts." He says, "The art is not to mind." One has to reach the point of desensitizing, as one said, as the Rambam said. How does one do it? If one's operating in the right levels, people can't hurt you. People can only hurt one's weaknesses. They can't hurt one's strengths. Things that you've really got, nobody can hurt. They hurt when they touch a weakness. So one has to see that there are not too many weaknesses lying around. And kaas, in other words, one of the ways of avoiding anger is to simply make sure that your reflex is not called into operation, because you never feel hurt. Sure, there's a physical reflex. If somebody hits you, you'll hit back. That's a physical reflex. But we're not permitted to extend that reflex beyond the physical body. And therefore, we've got to examine. If somebody angers you, and your response is to get him back, and you say something or you do something which hurts him back, that's a sign you've been hurt. It's a sign he won. Because if he didn't win, if he didn't hurt you, you wouldn't have hit back at him. The fact that you've hit back with the aggression rather than with the defense shows that you have been hurt, and you're letting on that you've been hurt. It's a concession of defeat. Let's look at Yaakov. Yaakov gets angry after 20 years of being hurt by Lavan, or what we would think would be being hurt by Lavan. Finally, Lavan just goes beyond the limit. It's the straw that breaks the camel's back. At last, Yaakov cannot contain himself. Vayichar apoy. Vayichar le Yaakov, and Yaakov becomes angry. For the first time in 20 years, he lets go. And what does he say? What did I do wrong? Why are you after me? What have I hurt you? Defensive, not aggressive. He hasn't been hurt. After the 20 years of dealing with Lavan, after being fooled around with the two daughters, after having to work for those 20 years when he really just came to stay and to have a bit of peace of mind, having to work like a slave, having been crooked at every turn, having to watch every moment and be aware that he isn't going to be crooked out of everything he's making, having to flee afterwards with Lavan's own daughters and grandchildren because he can't ask Lavan permission because Lavan won't give it. He's captured by Lavan. He's cornered by Lavan for 20 years. And he now wants to go home, and finally he gets out. And Lavan comes after him, accusing him of being a gunner, of you thief. Yaakov, who's worked with such straightness, who's gone far beyond what is required of him in terms of halachic straightness. If a sheep disappeared, he paid for it out of his own pocket. He worked day, he worked night, as he says himself to Lavan. The essence of straightness in dealing. And Yaakov comes out, and Lavan comes after him, you thief. And he still contains himself. Maybe it's one of my servants or something has stolen something of his. He doesn't know that Rachel has actually stolen the idols. And he waits while Lavan searches. Imagine letting that man, Lavan, search through one's whole household, all one's personal effects, everything, just standing aside, when there's nobody of a man searching through your goods, accusing you of having taken things of his. Eventually he says, I don't find anything. Now Lavan, Yaakov gets angry by Yicha, and he loses his temper. What does he do? Doesn't say, you so and so, 20 years you've crooked me, you real rotter. Nothing at all. Just, yeah, Lavan, what have I done to you? What have I hurt you? Have I been dishonest with you? Defensive. He sees the threat coming, he sees a man pursuing, but in all these 20 years, Yaakov has not been hurt. That's the godliness of Yaakov. That's the greatness. You're impervious to it, you don't feel it. You can't be hurt. Yes, you get angry because you see somebody coming for you, so you defend yourself. You're not sure that you can never be hurt. And it would be silly to assume that you can never be hurt. You've got to take defensive measures. But defensive, not offensive. It's never necessary for Yaakov to become offensive. It's never necessary for Yaakov to become aggressive because he's never been hurt. Lavan has never won. That depends, and it ties up a little bit to last week's shiur too. It depends what one's working for. If one's working for money and somebody does you out of a cent or a rand or a million rand, you're hurt. What you're working for has been frustrated. If your most important object in life is your motor car, and somebody scratches your motor car as they're driving past, no amount of sorries will stop you from swearing at him. Your reflex reaction will be to get out and, what do you think you're doing? Couldn't you see what was here? That's a reflex action. It wasn't his fault. Do you think he went into your car deliberately? But if your car is that important to you, that somebody more important to you than human relations, the reflex action, he hit your car, the same as hitting you. So you reflex out back, aggressive. It's a sign you've been hurt. It's a sign the car is important to you. And so it is with everything one goes, the things that are important to you. If somebody touches those things, it hurts. But if the things that are important to you are the kind of things which people can't touch, the kind of things which people can't take, the mitzvahs that you do, the chesed that you do, the kindness that you do, the tzedakah that you do, the knowledge that you acquire, the menschlichkeit that you develop, the avodas Hashem, one's relationship to the Ribbono Shel, one's relationship with one's family, one sense of integrity and straightness. If these are the things that are really of value, if this is what we're working for and striving for, who can hurt us? What can they take away? So they'll take away our houses, they'll take away our motor. What difference does it really make? If the Ribbono Shel Olam lets them take it away, it means we can manage without them. We thought we needed them, and he's telling us we don't need them. But it's not taking away anything that's terribly meaningful to us. And so one's able to develop a resistance to the little irritations of life. You're standing in a queue and the queue goes a little bit slower. So you get angry at the man standing in front of you or at the man serving the queue. You begin to get aggressive or to feel aggressive. This is part of the problems with the high rates of heart attacks in Johannesburg, because this is a symptom of Johannesburg life: chaos, anger. And it's the worst kind of place for it, really, because we have the symptom of anger together with British manners. So we don't vent that anger terribly easily. So we keep it inside and we get ulcers and heart attacks. That's why it's so high here. We have the American tendency to get impatient and angry together with the British manners, and the two together create heart attacks. So the British laugh at us. We've got their bad manners, but we get the heart attacks. They don't. We've got the Americans' bad manners, but we get the heart attacks. They don't. Because we've got the two of them. We've got the worst of both or the best of both, whichever you want to look at it. But that's no way to live. And you're driving in the traffic and the traffic's going slowly. So you start boiling and getting angry and getting frustrated. What is God helping? Becoming aggressive. What does it help? And you start taking it out on yourself or your motor car or the car in front of you or the person sitting next to you. Well, it's going to be somebody that you take it out on. Usually it will be on somebody who can't give it back to you. You know the story, the managing director kicks the deputy managing director, and the deputy managing director kicks his assistant, and his assistant kicks his secretary, and his secretary goes home and kicks her dog. And that's what eventually you'll find something to kick somebody to vent your frustration on and to become aggressive with. Why? Because you've been hurt. And when you're hurt, you've got to hurt back. Doesn't make any sense. So you're sitting in the traffic, so it takes a little bit longer. So you go over your Gemara a little bit. You turn on the tape, or you take out a sefer, or you think it out, you revise it by yourself, so you've got a bit of peace of mind between appointments. What does it bother you? There's nothing you can do to solve it. You can't get there any earlier in any event, so what's there to get angry about? It's part of the same middle of chaos. We're too easily angered. We're not desensitized enough to anger. We're desensitized to other people's feelings. We don't get angry when we see other people mistreated that easily. But for ourselves, just let anybody touch us, and we're angry. We're oversensitive. We're spoiled. We don't have a protective covering over ourselves. And the protective covering that we're talking about is the covering of being involved in bigger things than standing in queues and making a few cents and the normal things which get to bother people. It's very seldom that people get angry about big things. It's very seldom that people feel strongly enough about big things to get angry. I always get angry about the narishkeit and the little nonsense in life. That's what makes people angry. And one can't allow oneself to drop to that level of operation. And that was Yaakov. 20 years of this which would have driven any of us into Torah. Not with Laban, he's untouched. And the proof that he's untouched is when he finally does lose his temper, no aggression, only defense. That's Yaakov. After 20 years with Laban, it hasn't touched his private life. It hasn't touched his own standard of operation. It hasn't touched his family life. He remains intact. His family remains intact. His Torah remains intact. His Avodas Hashem remains intact. That can't be touched by Laban. No way. One of the disturbing things of the society in which we live, it's something I meant to raise last week, in fact, is the complete lack of being prepared to be moser nefesh a little bit for the important things in life, for integrity. To sacrifice a job for integrity, maybe. Sometimes one might have to do it. It's not something that you'll find people doing very often today. If I can't keep my integrity in my job, I have to get out of my job. Get out of my job, panosa? What will I live on? It always comes down to, what will I do? I'm being hurt. And we have such a low tolerance of pain that we're prepared to sell our souls just to avoid the pain. And we'll be dishonest, one level or another. We'll do a friend in, we'll do a colleague in, because if we don't, we're in trouble. And you'll just never find people, not never, you seldom find people today willing to put their heads on the block for a moral principle. You just don't find that. And that's something terribly disturbing. You don't find it in South Africa, you don't find it in America, you don't find it in Israel, nothing. Everybody does what will bring them the quickest back and the surest back, that's all. What happens to somebody else is their problem. It's not my business. So it all makes sense that we live in a society in which we get very angry. But I want to take it a step further. The Gemara says in Psochim Dav Samach Vav, and the Rambam brought it, the Rambam that I read to you in the second Perek, Reish Lakish says, Kol HaKoyes, anybody who gets angry, Im Chochom Hu, if he's a Chochom, Chochmosoi Mistalekes, Mimena. His wisdom disappears from him. His wisdom leaves him. What's the connection between chokhmah and anger? Why, if you get angry, does your wisdom leave you? Our whole life is and should be taken up with thinking. If we're not going to be thinking beings, then our life isn't worth living. Thinking means at all times evaluating the situation in which we find ourselves, analyzing it correctly, getting to the bottom of it, knowing what it really is, and creating the correct response to it. That's what life is about, and that's what thinking is about. And all our learning and all our thinking and all our talking and all our reading is to enrich our understanding of the environment in which we operate and the principles by which we should operate, to ensure that we understand our situations as they crop up every moment of the day, to ensure that we understand them correctly, analyze them, and respond to them correctly. We have to respond correctly because that's the key to success. If we respond correctly, everything works smoothly, both in our spiritual lives and our material lives. If we make a mess of the way we respond, then why should we make a mess of the way we respond? Because we didn't think. If you'll go back on your life and you'll think of all the times that you made major blunders, you'll figure out it's because you acted without thinking. And the moment after you do it, you realize what a stupid thing to have said or to have done. Because your mind was just working one half a second or one fraction of a second behind your reflex actions. And you did something, you reacted, and a moment later, using your mind, you realize it was wrong. And those are major mistakes which cause severe hassles in interpersonal relationships, in one's professional and business life, in one's religious life, in one's psychological life. They're major problems just because we didn't think. If we would just think and see ourselves and our situations correctly, lots of mishaps could be avoided. Even normal day-to-day accidents, driving accidents, bad health, all sorts of things which one tends to write off to nature and to just statistics, normal things, could be avoided if one approached it with a little bit of seichel. One just thought about what one's body is and how one has to look after it, and what one must eat and what one mustn't eat, and what kind of exercise one must do and what one mustn't do, and what kind of life one must lead, just from a physical point of view. If one just thought about what one is and the power and delicacy of one's own body, one would look after it properly. And if every time one got into a motor car, one realized what one was in, how inadequate is the protection of a motor car, it feels as if you're in a tank but you're really in a matchbox. It crackles up, somebody can hit you at 20 kilometers an hour and you can make a mess of your motor car. If you would just realize that that steel around you is not a protection at all, and that you're out in the open driving at great speeds, and that you're working on margins of errors of a few inches when you're driving between traffic and at high speeds, and you work out what your margin of error is, and you understand that that's how you're operating, you'll drive carefully, you'll drive alertly, you'll be careful. Sure, somebody can still go into you, but if he was also driving with seichel, he wouldn't go into you either. So if the world was operating with seichel, if we would all just think a little bit, the world would be a lot safer and a lot of better place to live. Kaas, anger, is reacting without thinking. It's reflex action. There's a big difference between reacting and responding. Reacting is reflex. You do something because something was done to you. It's a reaction. You couldn't help yourself. Or maybe you could, or maybe you couldn't. That's not terribly important. But a reaction is you did it because of input. It was an automatic reaction to something which you saw, or something you did, or something somebody did to you, or something you heard. There's some input which creates a reaction. You didn't create the reaction. The input creates the reaction. But there's a different concept altogether, which is response. Response is this input, and I take the input and I dwell on it for half a second, or for an hour, or for a week. The response doesn't have to come immediately. A reaction usually comes immediately. But a response can take a bit of time, and in these things, half a second is a long time. A quarter of a second is a long time. A response is, there's input, I see something, I hear something, I feel something, I put it inside my little computer, together with all my other feelings and my personality and everything else I've got there, and I mix it all up, and I taste it, and it's not quite right, and I change the proportions, and I mix it up again, and I have a look at it, and the colors aren't quite right, and I change the colors, and finally I come out with a response which I believe is the correct and a beautiful response to that particular situation. I'm drawing it up, but I say again, it might take a quarter of a second, it might take a tenth of a second. What's the difference? The difference is not in the time it takes to create a response as opposed to the time it takes to react. The difference is the one is an active event and the one is a passive event. In reacting, I'm just nothing. I'm just a channel. Something comes in and something else goes out. I did nothing. In responding, I'm the key to it. Yes, there's input. And there's a whole lot of input and it's all put together, but who makes the final blend? I do. Who satisfies himself that my response must be correct and that the response is suitable? I do. Who's responsible for the response? I am. In other words, in responding, we utilize input, but we don't subject ourselves to input. We don't make ourselves slaves to input. And here again, we live in a life where reacting is the order of the day. We don't precipitate. We don't confront. We wait until we're forced to do certain things. We react. Sometimes we react positively, sometimes we react negatively. But we get up when, if we would, we get up in the morning, when if we would not get up at that point, it would already cause problems. So at the last moment, we get up. And each, right through our day thereafter, we're doing things which if we didn't do would cause some kind of a problem or other. And we find this not only in the secular world, but also in the religious world. And that's why in religious education today, you find educators so terrified about the influence of the outside world. They have a good reason to be worried. The influence of television, the influence of the newspaper, the influence of books, the influence of literature. If you're reacting and not responding, if a child is not being taught to respond, but is being taught only to react, you've got to be very worried about what a child sees. In any event, one has to be worried. But if a child is only reacting, one has to be worried to the point of banning all contact with anything that could create a negative reaction. All violence, all forms of anything negative. You've basically got to put a blindfold over the child's eyes and not let him out of your house. Because he will react negatively, or he might react negatively to any negative input that he sees. Therefore, don't let him have any negative input. Therefore, watch what input he has. Whereas if a child is taught to respond, to take the input, to analyze it, to see it for what it is, to mix it all up inside, to figure out a correct response. One can respond correctly to negative input as one can to positive input. When one sees A murdering B, there's a response. If one sees a person telling a lie, there's a response. If one sees a person stealing, there's a response. Those are all negative things, but there's a correct response to those negative things. But today people don't use those negative responses. Why should I get involved? Those positive responses. Why should I get involved? A murdering B, I must get involved. Somebody stealing, I must get involved. Nobody's prepared to put their heads on the block for a moral principle. They're only prepared to react, not to respond. And so educators have to be worried what we see. We have to be worried about what we see if we're only going to respond. Response is the essence of chokhmah, or shall we say chokhmah, wisdom is the essence of response. The ability to respond correctly is both an analytical and a creative act. And both analysis and creativity require chokhmah, they require wisdom. Correct response requires a correct analysis of the situation and a correct creation of the response. The most creative thing one can do, respond. And one's doing it all day and all night, all the time one is responding, hopefully. It's the most creative thing there is. To see a situation, analyze it accurately, correctly, create a response, and produce the response. That there is no more creative work than that. It's like an artist who analyzes the social scene in which he lives, the social situation, writes a play to respond to that social situation, and produces the play. The whole thing he sees through, from the analysis, through the creation of the play, right through to the production of the play. We're doing that at every moment of our lives. We're analyzing situations, creating responses, and producing the responses to have the correct effect. If for a moment we allow ourselves to get angry, we're abandoning all subservience to our ability to respond. We're abandoning all derech eretz, all honor, all respect for our intellectual capacities. To react without thinking means that I'm unable to think about the correct way to react. So let me just react the way an animal would react. That's going to be better than I could possibly think. That's what it means. To abandon the thought process for one moment is already something which can cause permanent intellectual or serious intellectual and mental retardation. Not mental in a clinical sense, but mental in an intellectual sense. To cease being a thinking being for one moment can seriously retard one's progress. And that we see also from the beginning of the Sidra. I've told you about it before, where we're told that Yaakov came to Bethel on his way out from Beersheba. Vayishkav b'mokom ahu. Vayishkav b'mokum ahu, and he slept in that place. Says Rashi, b'mokum ahu, it's a miut that comes to exclude other places. He only slept there, says Rashi, because for the previous 14 years when he was learning in the yeshiva of Shem Va'eva, he didn't even sleep. And Reb Chaim Shmuelevitz used to say, and how did he sleep in Beit El? On the ground with his head on a stone, without any blankets. That's how he slept in Beit El. Says Reb Chaim Shmuelevitz, that means that for the 14 years he didn't even sleep on the ground with a stone at his head. Nothing. Why not? So you sleep for a few hours. It's a terrible thing. And he used to ask the question also with Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva, after learning for 12 years in his yeshiva, came back home. And as he came to the house, he heard that his wife was talking to a lady. And he heard the lady mocking and criticizing his wife and saying, "What kind of a husband have you got? What kind of a family life have you got? Off for 12 years, you never see him, you never hear from him. Is that the way to live?" And she said, "I appreciate what he's doing so much that if he wanted to come back and ask me for another 12 years, I would gladly give him another 12 years. So Rabbi Akiva turned back and he went on to learn for another 12 years. Asks of Chaim Shmulevitz, "You're there already. Come in and say hello. Have a cup of tea with your wife and go after tea. You don't have to just turn around and not even say hello to her. Not even put your head in. Nothing. You're there already. It's not time loss. You've come on a long journey from yeshiva to home and you're going back again. So you're going to be traveling for months. Can't you afford 5 minutes just to say hello and let us see that you're alright and how you've grown and how it's worthwhile?" Chaim used to say, 12 and 12 doesn't make 24. Not in ruchnis, not in spiritual things. To stop for one moment, one line of progress in spiritual matters, sets you back years. One moment can set you back years. That's how it is in spiritual things. That's how it is in everything worthwhile. If you're collecting, it doesn't matter. If you're collecting, you can stop for a while and you can carry on collecting after the break. If you're just collecting knowledge, or you're collecting pages of Gemara, or you're collecting money, or you're collecting antiques, whatever it is, and you say, "Look, for a year I don't want to collect." Okay, so you stop for a year, you carry on collecting after the year. There's nothing seriously lost. Nothing's lost more than the year that you spent. But if you're involved in developing yourself, if you're involved in changing yourself, in growing, you can't stop growing for a moment and say, "I'll carry on in a year's time, or in a day's time." Imagine a flower stop growing for a moment. Imagine a human being stop growing for a moment, physically. Said, "All right, look, I'm just going to die for half an hour and we'll carry on afterwards." It doesn't work. You can't stop. If you stop, you're finished. So it is with spiritual life. If you stop, you're finished. If you stop thinking for one moment in your life, your wisdom disappears. Because wisdom is a whole growth process. It's a whole organism, one thing on top of another, all the time. It's working, it's evolving, it's developing, it's growing, it's beautiful. But it has to be moving forward. If for one moment you stop your thinking process, you lose your wisdom. You lose that sharpness, you lose that precision, you lose that depth. And you just become ordinary again and you have to start from scratch. That's why I'm always so particular about the regularity with which one comes to shiurim. The regularity of one's own learning. To get into the habit of understanding that you can't stop learning. Nothing can get in the way. It has to go on. And if by onus, if by some emergency you can't make a shiur because you're somewhere else, then you stop at that time and you do your learnings without the shiur. But you can't stop. You can't stop a whole process. You can't stop a whole growth process and say, "I'll take it up where I left off." And that one has to extend not only to the moments that one learns, but to one's entire life or operation. One has to be a thinking person at all times. And one never gets tired thinking, because one's brain gets a rest by changing the subject, that's all. You don't have to relax your brain by stopping to think. One of the biggest tragedies brought to the modern world, or to the Western world, is the deception of transcendental meditation. Teach people to relax their brains by stopping to think. No. You relax your body by stopping to think. And transcendental meditation has fantastic physical advantages. One's able to feel very physically refreshed. And one thinks one feels mentally refreshed because one's brain is cleaned up. And one feels one can start afresh. And it's a nice feeling. But there's no dynamicism and there's no growth because you've stopped the growth process. It's dead. You've got to revitalize it and start from scratch again. Transcendental meditation is nothing for the brain. Something for the body, but not for the brain. One has to realize the brain doesn't need time to rest. Even when one's sleeping, the brain is working. The brain doesn't need time to rest. The brain has got to operate, the brain has got to work, and the more it works, the more it's in tone. And the only way it needs to rest is to change subjects. You think about one thing and you change, you think about something else. You learn Gemara, you learn Rambam, you read a good book, you carry on with your Gemara, you go to business, you do your work. As long as your brain's working all the time and you're thinking, and you know how easy it is to get into the habit of not thinking. In your work, to become parafashion about the way you do things. In swatting. In learning. One can learn one's Gemara without using one's brain. One can do anything without using one's brain. Life is so designed today that you can get by without thinking. The assumption of the social environment is that you're not going to think, so they've created a conveyor belt system. You just have to jump on and listen to the instructions, do what you're told to do more or less, and you'll get carried along basically, you'll get to the other end. But the only other end that's to be guaranteed to you is West Park Cemetery. More than that can't be guaranteed to you. You'll live your life and you'll die one day and you'll be buried. Everything will be okay. And if you've taken out the right kind of life insurance and so on, your family will be looked after you, and you can go away peacefully and there's nothing to worry about. That's, everything's organized in such a fashion. But to get somewhere, to achieve, that one has to fight against the non-thinking stream and start thinking. And starting to think means thinking in everything we do. Thinking every moment of the day. Working out what is the correct approach. In what way can I maximize on what I'm doing? In what way can I increase efficiency to the maximum of what I'm doing? That's the thinking process which has to exist right through one's day. And if not, chokhmoso mistalekes mimena. What about spontaneity? Does that mean that one only responds and one never reacts? That means one never expresses a purely spontaneous feeling. You really, somebody walks into the room and you're happy to see them, you don't think, you don't respond, nothing, just a reaction of smiling. Is that not allowed? Is that reaction rather than responding? There are two answers to that. The first answer is obviously, one must be able to respond at least as well as an animal does. If one says, look, I'm not, one must be able to react at least as well as an animal does. Clearly one's not meant to lose one's reflexibility. Clearly one's not meant to become so inhibited that one can't operate without thinking and figuring out, obviously. So one's basic instincts and ability to react have to be maintained and in fact developed. So what is the problem with spontaneity or with reaction? What we're worried about is that it's a physical reaction. What we're worried about is that it's not deep enough. That it's not really genuine enough. Somebody comes in, oh, I'm so pleased to see you, it's wonderful, fantastic. And you think afterwards, it was a bit overdone. Well, it's nice to see him and all the rest of it. That nice to see him. And one finds that it's really a physical reaction. He walked in and you reacted because you hadn't seen him a long time. It's a reaction, not a response. And it's superficial. One smiles. One can smile with one's mouth, and one can smile only with one's top lip, and one can smile with both one's lips, and one can smile with one's eyes as well. There's smiles and there's smiles. And one can have a reflex smile, but a reflex smile, the face never smiles. A reflex smile is only one's mouth. The muscles pull aside, it's a reflex, it is a reflex action. And laughter can be a reflex action. But a real, meaningful smile, that's a response. That's something that's created inside of one, not created outside of one. Reaction is when my reaction is created by something or someone outside of me. Response is when it's created by me. Because I really do appreciate you, that's why I'm smiling. Not because you just create that kind of response in me, that kind of reaction in me. What we're worried about in the case of reaction is that it's not really you that are reacting. We said, you are made up of two parts and many parts, but two basic parts. There's an animal part of you and there's a spiritual part of you. How do you know that your reaction is really the spiritual, essential you that is reacting? If it's response, that's one of the things you're checking when you create your response. Is this really me? How do I really want to respond? What's the correct thing to do over here? How would I want it to come out? There's a whole tremendous amount of you that goes into creating the response. But in reaction, it's a bit reflex, or very reflex, and you're never quite sure whether it's you or it's you. Whether it's the spiritual, essential you or it's just the physical you. So if somebody punches me and I punch him back, that's the physical me. Okay, I know that. But if somebody does something nice or something good and I react, is it really me? Somebody gives me a delicious plate of food. I taste it and I say, this is fantastic. is that really me talking? Did I really say that after I created the response inside me that that's what I wanted to say? Or is it just that I'm hungry and my feelings are, I really want to tell this person how wonderful the food is because it's fed my body. Not because I really appreciate what's gone into it and the thought that went into it and the beauty and the tastiness of it. It's not a thought out response. It's not an evolved and a developed response. It's just the first thing that comes to mind. You want to say something, so you say it in the simplest and most superficial way possible. That's reaction. That's what we're worried about in reaction. The Maharal goes further, and it's difficult to understand what the Maharal really means, but the Maharal actually says that any form of physical excitement is an indication that you are responding to something physical, not spiritual. Spiritual things don't excite you physically. You know, the Litvische Misnagdim are often criticized of being cold and unemotional. And it's so false and it's so wrong. They don't show much of it outside. They're not physically jubilant. They're not physically jumping up and down. It's all inside, but when there is a response, it's so beautiful. When a Litvische Grodel smiles, it's such a smile. When he dances, it's a real dance. He's not just dancing in reaction to the songs. People start singing and clapping and he starts dancing like a puppet. Not like that at all. It's a response. It's something that's created out of him. He sets the tone. He creates the desire to dance and expresses that desire to dance. And so it is with everything he does. And if you walk into a Litvische Grodel's house, he doesn't jump off his chair and say, "Ah, and slap you on the back, haven't seen you for a long time, come down." It takes a while to warm him up. He starts getting to know you, responds to you, re-establishes a connection with you, and it can take hours and sometimes days and sometimes weeks and sometimes years before the warmth starts coming out. But when the warmth comes out, it's not just because he feels one must be polite or that's the way to do it or to make a friend. When the warmth comes out, it's warmth which comes right from deep in his heart, warmth he's been working on for years, trying to develop that genuine warmth. It's genuine. And we must be careful not to confuse spontaneity with genuineness. While any spontaneous action is genuine, not all genuine actions need to be spontaneous. A spontaneous action is genuine and superficial. It's an animal action. It's a reflex action. It's sometimes beautiful. It's sometimes lovely. It's sometimes friendly. And one doesn't have to stop reacting altogether. But one has to know that one's spontaneous actions are the most superficial of all actions, the most genuine and the most superficial. But one can be equally genuine and a lot deeper by responding rather than reacting. By absorbing the input, working it inside one, analyzing the situation, not just analyzing mentally, but analyzing emotionally, digesting it and producing a response which is one's own. That can be a tremendously honest and, of course, a very deep self-expression. Mustn't think that spontaneity is the only way to be honest and the only way to be one's real self. On the contrary, spontaneity is like when the doctor hits your knee. It's honest and it's shallow. It's not you. It's the same as anybody. The genuineness of an unspontaneous action obviously is dependent on having some form of absolute means of testing. Honesty and reality. If you don't have an absolute means of testing, how will you ever know that what you're doing is honest? So one needs halacha. Without halacha, this isn't going to work. This whole system isn't going to work without some kind of test as to the truth and the validity of the response I've created. Otherwise, who'll know whether the response is a figment of my own imagination or it's genuinely the correct response? What would happen if there was a human being who wasn't made up of two parts, who was only spiritual? He was completely spiritual. And he reacted spontaneously. Would there be any lack of depth in that spontaneous action? No. The only reason that our spontaneous actions aren't deeper because we're afraid that it's our physical reflex action which is producing them, rather than our spiritual essential self. But if we only had a spiritual essential self, and we reacted spontaneously, then it would be ideal. And that's something that one has to understand, that in the ideal, there is a place for pure spontaneity. In the ideal, there is a place for reaction. Assuming I could achieve what is really meant of me, each individual could achieve what is really required of them, that is the ultimate spiritualization of their bodies. Not separation, as it is today. In death, our bodies and souls are separated. It was never meant to be that way. was meant to be like Eliyahu HaNovi, where his body became spiritualized. His body wasn't left lying and rotting in a hole in the ground. That isn't the way it was meant to be at all. We're meant to spiritualize our body. Our physical beings have to become totally enwrapped and dominated by our spiritual beings until we are completely spiritual. And that was the original idea of death before the chait, before the sin of Adam HaRishon. But it wouldn't be death, but it would be death would be an evolutionary step in one's growth process, not a tearing apart of a human being. And if one could get to that stage, theoretically, where one's able to spiritualize oneself completely, and one reacted, that reaction would be accurate. It would be genuine, it would be yourself, it would be deep, it would be accurate, it would be everything. So in theory, yes, the spontaneous action is the most valuable of all. But that's only if you're a perfectly pure human being. Then you can be sure that your spontaneous action is perfectly pure. But if you're not a perfectly pure human being, you have to worry all the time that a spontaneous action is either a wrong action, as in the case of anger, where you hit offense with offense, or it's an action which is really very superficial and meaningless. One has to rather respond rather than react, to make sure that it's me from deep inside that is responding as I would want to be, in a way I would be proud of, not only now but in 5 minutes' time as well. For that I have to respond, not react. But Lu Yatsuya, imagine I could be a perfectly perfect human being, I wouldn't have to go through that process. I could allow myself to react freely. And that's with Yaakov Avinu. Yaakov Avinu is the Bechira Ovis, and we're told that the Ovis Hen Hen Hamerkova. The Ovis, the forefathers, were part of God themselves. They were totally spiritualized human beings. We have no conception of the greatness of Avraham, Yitzchak and Yaakov. We can't imagine it. And part of our inability to understand the Chumash is because we see them like normal human beings made up of body and soul. They were normal human beings made up of body and soul, but they spiritualized their bodies to such a degree, they raised their bodies to such a level that there was hardly a barrier, or possibly no barrier, between body and soul. It was all one, it was all spirit, it was all ruchnius. Ha'ovis, hein hein ha-merkova. The ovis were themselves the merkova, the presence of God himself. That's what the ovis were. And ov, one of the ovis can afford to get angry. He can afford to let himself react. And the proof of it is Yaakov after Lavan. What does he do when he's angry? Doesn't get offensive. He reacts. But he reacts in a way which is menschlich. He reacts in a way which is fine. He reacts the way we would respond if we allowed ourselves to respond. If we would figure out the response and take a long time over studying the whole situation and letting our tempers cool down before we spoke to Lavan, maybe we would come out with the same kind of approach as Yaakov did. But Yaakov could do it spontaneously because Ha'ovis Hein Hein HaMerkava. There was no barrier between spiritual and physical. Yaakov knew it was his spirit that would respond. It wasn't his Gashmis, it wasn't his physical being that would respond. Likewise, in the earlier case, we are told where Yaakov gets angry with his wife. Rachel says she wants children, and he says, "Do you think I'm God?" Says the Sipurnim. Vayichar, he became angry, al omroi havali, but because she said, "Give me sons," ki'ilu hayob beyadei la'asose, as if she was implying that Yaakov had the power to give her children. Beko'as bekin osoi lechovod koinai, and he became angry in his zealousness and jealousness for the honor of God. There is the concept of a kanoi. Remember Pinchas? Pinchas reacts spontaneously and kills Zimri. It's spontaneous, but he's completely spiritualized. If he would be a man who has a physical part and a spiritual part, and the two aren't completely integrated, then Pinchas would never have been allowed to kill Zimri. Because who says it would have been a genuine reaction, a spiritual reaction? Maybe it would have been jealousy. Maybe it would have been some kind of anger. No, Pinchas was angry because of the Ribbono Shel. God had been hurt and Pinchas reacted. And the same with Yaakov. Rachel hurts God. Yaakov, as God's representative, reacts on behalf of God, not on behalf of himself. Ha'ovis hen hen ha-merkova. When one of the others get angry, it's no physical part of them that's getting angry. When they'll react as they will, there's no chance that it's a physical reaction, that it's a jealousy, that it's an anger in a normal sense. Because hen hen ha-merkova, there's no split, there's no division. between the spiritual and the physical in the case of the ovis. They are altogether spiritual, and their reactions are spiritual, and they're allowed to get angry. And there we have the answer to the two prokim of the Rambam, the first parak and the second parak. In the first parak, the Rambam is talking of ideals. Ideally, there is a middle path for kaas, for anger. Ideally, there is a place for angry, if you're the right kind of person. If you're a person who's on the level of an Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, or a Pinchas, there is a place to get angry, but it has to be a spiritual anger, not a physical anger. In the second chapter, he's talking only about the practical side of things, where in practice, the first step is to make sure that one doesn't get hurt. The first step is to make sure that one's operating in such a level where one has no need to react with anger. Because one doesn't feel the hurt, one has the time to figure it out carefully and to respond rather than to react. Not so with arrogance. Arrogance there's no place for at all. Not in a perfect person, not in an imperfect person. No place for arrogance in an Avram, no place in a Yitzchak or a Yaakov or a Moshe, David, Aaron, nobody. You can't have arrogance. And that's why arrogance the Rambam leaves out. There's no middle path for arrogance. Kaas, anger. In theory there's a middle path. When you get to the level you can start using a middle path. But ordinary people like us have to get rid of anger totally. We have to move it right away. So we see with Yaakov, he was on the level of the first chapter of the Rambam. He was able to react. He could permit himself the luxury of reacting spontaneously on certain occasions, even when it was anger, because he knew that anger was spiritual. He knew that anger was meaningful. We, however, have to see that we never get into the situation of getting angry, because when we do, we're definitely likely to do that which is we will regret later on. And the only way that we can really avoid getting into situations of anger is by making sure that the things that people can hurt are not things that are terribly important to us. We have to increase our appreciation of the spiritual things of life. I don't mean only the religious things of life. We have to increase our appreciation of the quality of life and play down the quantity a little bit. We have to take off an hour and walk through an art gallery. We have to take off time to read a brilliant piece of literature, of a work of art. One has to spend time with one's family and not just do it because it has to be done and tick it off one's list. But do it with nachas, enjoy it, find pleasure, be able to say to yourself at the end of it, that's what life is really about. To be able to come out of a shiur, or when you finish working on a piece of Gemara or Chumash or whatever it is, and say, now this is what life is about. To be able to walk out of an art gallery and say, now this is living. To be able to have spent an afternoon with one's family and say, this is living, this is what life is all about. To be able to come away from qualitative experience with that feeling, that's what one has to do, and it needs work. One has to work on it. So at the end of the day, one's able to say to oneself, what happened today? What did I do? And the things you'll look back on, the things that will stand out, will not be the material things. The material things are only means to get to these qualitative things of life, to these qualitative experiences. And once one's got there, one must forget about the material things. They don't play a part. They were only the stepping stones to reach the magnificent experiences which every day holds out for us, and which unfortunately we let go in disappointment every day without even noticing, without even seeing, because we're so busy concentrating on the stepping stones across the river that we don't stop to look around and see how beautiful the river is, and the sound of the water flowing past, and the pretty little fish playing in the water, and the birds singing in the air. We're so busy that chas v'shalom, I should fall and get wet. Me, fall and get wet, so I'm watching carefully as I walk and I miss the whole thing. And that's the story of our lives. We're so busy with the means that we don't notice what the thing is really all about. And if somebody in joke or in seriousness moves a stone out of our path or gives us a little shake just as we're about to go, we punch them, we hit them, we get aggravated and angry. They're messing around with my stones. Forget the stones a moment, look around. It's a nice day today. And we have to be able to do that. We have to be able to relax in the beauty of what the Ribbono Shel Olam has given us.